This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Eric Spanberg, in for Mike Collins. Welcome to the Friday News Roundup. Today, we'll discuss the latest machinations in the state's long-running, some might say endless, partisan battle over the boundaries of House and Senate districts in the General Assembly. Also in the news this week, controversial remarks by the new county health director, who is under fire for explaining unusually high HIV rates by calling Charlotte a party town. Charlotte Mecklenburg Schools grapples with buses catching fire and separately sets earlier deadlines for magnet schools. Plus, a disputed investigation into Duke Energy and coal ash, and more headaches at Cardinal Healthcare. Joining me today are Tom Bullock of WFAE.
Hey there.
Ann Doss Helms of the Charlotte Observer.
Hello.
Kirsten Garris of Spectrum News.
Hello, hello.
And he's on your side, Nick Oxner of WBTV.
Not on Tom's side. Good morning.
Not on Tom's side. See, that's why I skipped. I didn't want you paired together. Let's start with these legislative maps. This week, the Stanford law professor appointed to redraw the illegal gerrymanders because of violations of racial guidelines and other rules, submitted his initial draft maps. So, Tom, you've covered this closely. How many districts are in play, and could this have meaningful impact on the current Republican majorities, which I think are 35-15 and 74-46, that's Senate and House?
Exactly. Let's start a little bit with Nathaniel Persily, who is the Stanford professor that you spoke about. These maps are not necessarily going to be accepted by the court. The court did something very interesting here, and this is the long-running now case that deals with 28 racially gerrymandered districts. This was, you know, found to be the case by a lower federal court, upheld over the summer by the U.S. Supreme Court. So now we're in the remedial phase of this trial. So in that phase, plaintiffs went to the original federal panel, which is now in charge of making sure the remedy takes effect. And they complained that the General Assembly, when it redrew the districts, which not to do too many dates here, but it finished that process in September, that they did two things wrong. The first is they did not directly affect or change all of the illegal racial gerrymandered districts. And the second thing, which I thought was very interesting, is that they changed too many districts. The plaintiffs in this case argued that the state altered districts that they didn't need to alter, and North Carolina happens to have a constitutional ban on what's known as mid-decade redistricting, which stops the party in power from just constantly changing the districts to stay in power. So the court, again, has not ruled on this.
Right.
But in order to save time and to make sure that all of this is ready for the next year's election for the General Assembly, they hired Persily to do his own redrawing of a handful of districts. And since they're puzzle pieces, it's the easiest way to think of these districts, you know, some knock-on districts would have to be changed. The big headline here is we don't know yet the full impact this may have on Republican supermajorities in either the House or the Senate. And part of that reason is if you look at this draft plan, you know, it doesn't look like it's necessarily going to change a whole lot if you look at how these districts voted in, say, the 2016 presidential election. But this is a draft plan, and it doesn't include some really important things like where the incumbent lives. So Persily was given the order that he should try to make sure that the incumbents stay in these districts. However, you know, he's just now going to add that information in. So they're going to morph a little bit more. And what's at play here is something called double bunking, which is basically putting two incumbents in the same district. Try not to do that because, you know, for political reasons, and it just can be problematic for incumbents. So we'll just have to wait and see on the final determination of if this has a huge impact on the makeup of the General Assembly or not.
So now there are a couple of Charlotte seats that could be affected, correct?
That's correct. Most are in South Charlotte. I spoke with you know, everybody's favorite political scientist, Michael Bitzer from Catawba College, about this, and he looked at it, again, using that scope, using the 2016 presidential vote counts as kind of the way to measure the partisan breakdown of these specific districts. And one district, which is represented by Democrat Chaz Beasley, looks to it's a safe Democratic district, but that looks to be shifted just slightly, a little bit less safe of a Democratic district, but still a somewhat safe Democratic district. But you look at a few other districts, and you know, Scott Stone, Republican representative, Bill Brawley, another Republican representative, their districts don't really change all that much. If anything, they might have become a little bit more safe Republican seats. There is one oddity, though, I want to bring up on this, which is Jeff Tartt's senatorial district. Originally,
up at Lake Norman.
Yeah, its anchor is up in North Mac, and originally it had this like leg that hugged the eastern side of Mecklenburg County to make it a very Republican district. When the General Assembly redrew the districts, they redrew Senator Tartt's district and flipped it. So it's still anchored up in North Meck, but now the leg goes along the western side, which is more Democratic. So the plaintiffs in this case asked the court to have that district redrawn, claiming that it violated that constitutional ban on mid-decade redistricting. For whatever reason, and I'm not sure why, the court has never said, they actually did not order Persily, the special master, to redraw that district. And so it currently is going to stay redrawn.
So I guess how much uncertainty is there given that we're 2 years away from the next census, and of course the Supreme Court is considering the Wisconsin case, which is not racial gerrymandering but partisan gerrymandering. Yeah. We don't know how they're going to rule, but it feels like whatever the conclusion is here is likely to be upended pretty quickly.
Well, and that's the thing here. Whatever the panel, the local panel of the three judges at the trial court level rule on Persily's maps, whether they accept them or not, is almost undoubtedly going to be appealed again to the United States Supreme Court from North Carolina again as well. So we've gone up and back once. The legislature drew new maps. Those have now partially been thrown out. We've gotten another guy.
Potentially thrown out. We don't know if they've been – since the court has not ruled, we don't know if they have been thrown out.
Right. So then we had another guy come in and draw some more maps, and who knows if the court will accept those. And then the Republicans will probably appeal it again. So we're a long way from certainty. But it's still interesting to me that the court – took the step of not making a ruling but hiring a guy to do some stuff that they might use if they make
hiring a guy for $500 an hour.
And the state picks up that tab.
Right.
But, you know, it's a great point to bring up, Nick, but here's the court rationale. It's all about time. It's all about wanting to make sure that no matter what the court rules, that the state, you know, the North Carolina State Board of Elections have time to do all the things necessary to make sure that whatever new map is picked, and basically the three-judge panel, the federal judges, have a menu of the maps they can pick. Whichever map is picked, if there are significant changes, it can be implemented in time for the election to run as normal.
And I'm still not actually, frankly, sure that it could be. I mean, filing's what's supposed to start in December, right, for the 2018 races, I believe. September or early 2018, but we're coming up very quickly for filing periods. And what we saw last time, there was supposed to be a special election this year for these legislative seats.
Right.
When that got – that was handed down by this three-judge panel. That got appealed to the U.S. Supreme Court, and the U.S. Supreme Court ended up saying, let's not do that. And so we could have that same thing happen again if we run too far into 2018 and we could see these same districts go for yet another round and just wait till we have census and redistricting.
And I guess the point I'm getting at is that even the most dedicated citizen, I mean, your head is pretty much exploding when you go through this process over and over again.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Even the legislature's heads are exploding, I think, up in Raleigh.
Let's switch gears. This week, the county health department is back in the news again, and it's not the kind of attention anybody wants. So back in June, county manager Dina DiIorio named Gibby Harris to the job on an interim basis. She was following Dr. Marcus Plesha, whose tenure was marred by widespread failure to notify women about abnormal pap smear test results. So last month, the county dropped the interim title and named Harris its health director, and now she's under scrutiny for offering this explanation for Mecklenburg's soaring HIV rates.
We, in cities like Charlotte, which draws a lot of people in, it can be a party town. It can be a place where people come in, enjoy themselves for the weekend, and then leave, but leave stuff behind.
So, Kirsten Garris, why did this take several weeks to turn into an issue?
That is still a question I'm trying to figure out myself. It's one of those things, it started to pick up some speed this Monday when some kind of commissioner said, you know what, actually we didn't really like how Gibby Harris phrased that, used the party town term. And as you can hear, and how she said it, she wasn't, you know, saying it. It wasn't like, oh, you know, we're a party town. She was kind of saying it, you know, that could be just – it was like a matter-of-fact way. So it was one of those things I think looking back, she's like, oh, that might not have been the right way to phrase why we have such a high HIV new infection rate. And she was trying to find a way to explain it because county commissioners were like, well, why us? Why is this happening? So she talked about drugs may the issue may be a factor in demographics and then this whole location thing. But it's interesting how this kind of picked up speed Monday with it kind of coming to light with an article from the Charlotte Observer. And then you saw Dina DiIorio came out with a statement kind of saying, hey, you know, we're defending her like she has experience from Wake County. She knows her stuff. This is why she made the comment. Tuesday, you had MECPAC, an LGBT rights group who came out saying, hey, this is not the best way to phrase this. This is stigmatizing people who are HIV positive. They were calling for an apology from Dina Durio and Gibby Harris. And then Wednesday, we got that apology from Gibby Harris. So it's interesting how it kind of escalated quickly. And it's just one more thing, as you mentioned, the health department doesn't want any bad press. And this is just one more thing to add to the laundry list of things they've had this year.
And real quick, Tom, before you respond, I wanted to mention that Bill James also this week said that he agreed with her statement and blamed a lack of monogamy as a primary cause of the HIV rates in town. Go ahead, Tom.
Yeah, and he did that. I mean, the defense of Director Harris is, you know, it's coming from different people, but so are the, you know, pointing out that this statement isn't correct. I agree with everything that Kirsten just said, but one thing that I find just strange, especially for someone who's in charge of the county's health department, is the defense that Dina Diori, or the county manager, gave her included she has knowledge of these things in Wake County. Okay, that's a whole other place. And she has anecdotal evidence.
That was the one that caught a lot of people's attention.
Anecdotal evidence in this kind of situation is not enough to make such a broad proclamation.
Well, particularly when we're talking about science, right?
Exactly. And I mean, honestly, as a human being, I don't want my health, you know, my health treatment to be defined by anecdotal anything. I want it to be defined by actual factual findings.
Well, and I think it is clearly established that unprotected sex and needle drug use can be ways that HIV is transmitted. And I think the question is with her characterizing that as partying, because as people have pointed out, that's not always a voluntary fun, you know, hey, let's go out and do some wild and crazy things. There are people in the sex trade who don't want to be there. You know, needle drug addiction is certainly not a joke and not a fun thing.
Absolutely. But in addition to, and this is one thing that also bothers me, is this implication that it only comes from outside. Well, let's be honest. If we want to deal with these very difficult issues, and they are difficult and they are entangling and they need to be dealt with in an appropriate way, we have to start by looking at ourselves and not blaming some random outsider that came in for a party. You know, there are plenty of things that happen here in Mecklenburg County, whether it's the sex trade, whether it's opioid addiction, whatever it is, it's being done by Mecklenburg County residents. And until we acknowledge that and look at why, we can't possibly hope to deal with it.
Well, and you know what I thought, Tom, as you're saying that, is remember when the protests turned into riots, there was this just false narrative that the people being arrested were all coming from far-flung states, when in fact the vast majority were local people, Charlotte area, Charlotte region. Kirsten, I want to ask you, obviously Dina Diorio has been through a lot with this health department. So, you know, how does she and how do the commissioners begin to restore any faith in this health department when they keep having these controversies pop up?
You know, that's a really good question for Dina Diorio, because it is a tough road that they're on. It's almost like we almost finished the year and we haven't talked about the health department in months. It was like, okay, we're on a new path. We have a new health director. And then it's like, this happens. So it's tough. I think what they're trying to do is just, again, try to patch up this narrative, because, again, it might have been it was a poor choice of words. It was kind of taking, you know, relying on anecdotal things versus, again, true facts. But I think it's one of those things that Gibby Harris is starting her tenure as health director on not the best foot, but we'll see moving forward what happens.
That was Kirsten Garris with Spectrum News. When we come back on the Friday News Roundup, we're going to discuss the unexplained school bus fires in Charlotte and look into a coal ash report that has Duke Energy and UNC Charlotte pushing back. Stay with us. This is the Friday News Roundup with Eric Spanberg in for Mike Collins.
The news roundup continues in a moment on 90.7 WFAE. Our support comes from WFAE members and NC Warren presenting Clean Path 2025, a strategy to slow climate change, save money, and create jobs with local solar power and battery storage. ncwarren.org. And Discovery Place Science, featuring inventions of engineering genius Leonardo da Vinci. Attendees will experience inventions from flying machines to the world's first bicycle. Da Vinci's Machines at Discovery Place Science. Coming up Monday on Charlotte Talks, Dr. David Goldfield from UNC Charlotte takes a look at post-World War II America in his new book, The Gifted Generation, When Government Was Good. In it, he chronicles the efforts made by Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Johnson to make rights equal for minorities and women, to create better access to education, and provide greater opportunities for individual success. Dr. David Goldfield joins guest host Eric Spanberg to talk about it on Monday on Charlotte Talks at 9 on WFAE.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. Coming up on the next On Point, more women accuse Roy Moore. The tax bill goes after Obamacare, Jeff Sessions' hazy memory. Our weekly news roundtable goes behind the headlines. That's coming up on the next On Point from NPR.
On Point, coming up at 10, right after Charlotte Talks and the Friday News Roundup, here on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
Back on Charlotte Talks, it's the Friday News Roundup. I'm Eric Spanberg, in for Mike Collins. Our panel today includes Tom Bullock of WFAE, Ann Doss Helms from the Charlotte Observer, Kirsten Garris of Spectrum News, and WBTV's Nick Oxner. And Nick, your investigative report this week on the relationship between Duke Energy and researchers at UNCC and questions about studies of coal ash sites stirred up a lot of conversation this week. Let's start with a portion from your story.
That all sounds like my language.
Sir, this is added by Duke in the track changes and the highly suggested edits. This was added by Duke.
I recognize that text that you're reading, and I wrote that.
How can you sit here in front of me and tell me that this email with these documents is something that you wrote when we have the evidence that that's not true?
Now, I guess I haven't really seen, I don't acknowledge that that's evidence.
So, Nick, walk us through this a little bit, who you're talking to and kind of how this story came about, obviously raising questions about coal ash research.
Sure. So that clip that you just heard is me doing an interview with Dr. Bill Langley, who's a research professor at UNC Charlotte. And since 2013 or so, Dr. Langley's been working on research into coal ash and specifically its impacts on groundwater. And so in April, I submitted a public records request to UNC Charlotte because Dr. Langley and one of his colleagues, a guy named John Daniels, also a professor at UNCC, work at UNCC. Their emails and work product is subject to the Public Records Act, even though they're working for Duke or one of Duke's contractors. So in April, I submitted a public records request to UNC Charlotte for all of their communication with Duke and all of their reports and their draft reports for all of that from 2013 to April of this year. So they provided that to me several months later in September. We went through it all. It's thousands and thousands of pages of emails and documents. And what we uncovered, among other things, is that report that we were just talking to Bill Langley about. And what that shows, we uncovered an email from Duke Energy, from an engineer at Duke Energy, to Dr. Bill Langley, who wrote this report. Dr. Langley's been passed off by Duke as an independent scientist who's conducted independent research on coal ash. But what we found, among other things, again, is Duke had made their words in an email, highly suggested edits to a report in one of Dr. Langley's reports about his research into coal ash that made pretty substantial changes to at least one of his reports. And so that's what we were talking about in that soundbite.
And this week, after your story ran, both Duke Energy and UNCC have responded in part to your story. Also, WFAE aired a report in which they spoke to you, and The Observer published an editorial that also used a lot of the research that you had done. UNCC has a fairly detailed rebuttal, is what they call it, on their website, and I'm going to read a little bit of this. They describe Nick's story as one that contained numerous inaccuracies and mischaracterized the roles of engineering professors John Daniels and Bill Langley in their research into the impact of coal ash ponds on groundwater. That story was amplified Tuesday evening by radio station WFAE, which aired a promotional interview with a TV reporter with no balancing sources, and the Charlotte Observer repurposed the WBTV report with no inquiries made for balance as an editorial in its print edition. I also want to read you a quote from Robert Wilhelm, who's the UNCC Vice Chancellor for Research and Economic Development. And he says, quote, "The coverage attempts to suggest conflicts where they don't exist. Among the many inaccuracies were the TV reporters' repeated assertions that our researchers are somehow compensated by Duke Energy for their work. They are not, and that was stated more than once but ignored." He goes on to say, "We stand strongly behind the quality and integrity of the research done by Professors Langley and Daniels." The report that Nick did and also the rebuttal are both on the website at wfae.org/Charlotte Talks. Nick, I want to give you a chance to respond to what they're saying about your story.
Sure. We don't attempt to assert anything. All we've done is published facts, and those facts are in documents provided by the University of North Carolina, Charlotte. And if you read the emails, what you see is that there are Duke engineers sending emails to a professor that works at an institution that has been paid more than $1 million from Duke and Duke's contractors to research coal ash. And in those emails are suggestions of highly suggested edits. We also know from these emails that Duke was approving the underlying models that Dr. Langley was using to conduct his research. He was supposed to be doing this research independent, which means you don't talk to Duke about how to do your research. That's generally what someone thinks of as an independent scientist, right? That's what I think of anyways. But we know from all of these thousands of emails that we have posted every bit of the documents that we got from UNC Charlotte on our story at WBTV.com. If anyone wants to go read them for yourself, you're welcome to. But we know from these emails that Dr. Langley was consulting with Duke about things like the underlying models. We know that Dr. John Daniels, the other UNCC professor, who chairs a supposedly independent coal ash advisory board made up of other PhDs from around the country, we know at the same time that he's chairing this board and writing letters to DEQ advocating for them to take positions that would be favorable to Duke Energy, we know that as he's writing that, Dr. Daniels is also consulting with the top executives at Duke Energy about how to craft their message and their meetings and presentations to DEQ. The same regulators that he's writing as a, quote, independent expert and chairman of this board. And so don't take my word for it. I'm not suggesting anything. I'm publishing facts.
So those were the words of Nick Oxner, who did the story this past week about coal ash research and the relationship between Duke Energy and researchers at UNC Charlotte. I do want to mention for people who may have forgotten that the reason coal ash has become such a hot topic is because in February of 2014, there were 39,000 tons of coal ash that went into the Dan River. Obviously, that was a Duke Energy facility. And since then, we've had a number of cases and investigations related to how coal ash is handled across the state. Tom, you wanted to respond as well.
Yeah, I do, because obviously UNC Charlotte is also taking issue with the fact that we interviewed Nick about his story. And I, you know, they call it promotional. I do think it's absolutely, since they bring it up, I think it's absolutely valid for us to respond that promotional is absolutely the wrong word. We interview at WFAE journalists who do digs into stories that we haven't because they have an interesting story we think our audience wants to hear. We've interviewed numerous reporters from other – you know, we've interviewed you, Eric. We've interviewed people from the Charlotte Observer. So to call it promotional is a vast mischaracterization. We have no agreement with WBTV. In fact, your partner is the Charlotte Observer, not us. I also have an issue with – just certain things in this response. And I encourage people to read it and to decide for themselves. The response itself also includes Nick's script.
And again, that's at wfae.org/Charlotte Talks if you want to take a look at that.
But just strange things in there that stand out to me. Like at one point, Nick interviews a lawyer from the Southern Environmental Law Center and identifies him as a lawyer from the Southern Environmental Law Center who is in, you know, who is currently in litigation with Duke Energy. UNC Charlotte felt the need to put in their rebuttal that these – and they put quotes around the term environmental lawyers – are currently suing Duke Energy. Okay. Yes. And it's something that was pointed out in Nick's story. I don't think that's a disqualifying or a point or a point of fact. It's an odd thing they put in there. But really what's at the heart here is the idea of independent. Independent means something. And we can quibble and have an academic conversation about what the word independent means. However, I think for me just as a person, but also me as a journalist, independent implies that you don't necessarily take highly suggested edits from a document. And if you do, then you note that there were changes made at the request of Duke. I mean, you can be independent, you can be an advisory board, you can be an organ of industry, whatever it is. If you're transparent about it, it helps your own credibility. And that's something in that clip that you played of Nick's interview, I think is worth noting that, you know, it would have been very easy for Dr. Langley simply to say yes, and here's why.
Yeah, and I read through the rebuttal, and believe me, I don't know this story anywhere to the degree that you do, Nick, but one of the things that seemed to be a recurring theme in terms of the response from UNCC was that without Duke's cooperation, essentially the research is either ineffective or untenable. And I just wonder, what was your thought on that? I assume you read that as well.
Well, that's interesting in and of itself, because that's the exact same talking point that we got from Duke Energy before the story published. So I don't know if Duke and UNCC have coordinated, but their talking points are now exactly the same, and they weren't when we started down this road. But that's also a shifting explanation from Bill Langley. When we talked to Bill Langley in that clip you heard, Bill Langley first tried to tell me that he wrote the words that I have in the track changes from Duke Energy, that Duke Energy clearly wrote. Then he said, well, it probably didn't change the underlying science. Then Duke said, well, this was a collaborative process. And now Bill Langley's come and said, well, these were actually and UNC Charlotte in their rebuttal has come and said, well, these were not just highly suggested edits from Duke. These were the edits that we all made collaboratively. First of all, there's no evidence of that in the documents. In fact, Duke had previously made edits to Dr. Langley's reports back in October when he first finished the draft. And there's no evidence that Langley had a part in drafting these, quote, highly suggested edits that were sent to him the morning the report was due. But third, that's at least the third or fourth explanation about this collaboration. And so it continues to shift.
So do you think there is more for you to do on this story?
I know there is. Stay tuned.
Well, that's a good cliffhanger.
And let me just say this, too. We're presenting sides of stories here. And I really do encourage everyone who's listening to go, whether it's to UNC Charlotte's website, Nick's website, WBTV, our website, WFAE, the Charlotte Talks page that has this rebuttal there, read it.
Yeah, I would say, Tom, I mean, the thing that is really interesting here is there are a ton of documents between all those
sources. Go read the emails.
Sources.
Look, when I do a report like this, I believe very strongly that if it should, one, be based on facts and evidence, and two, that I should share those facts and evidence that back up what I'm saying. I didn't just make this up out of nowhere. We very much have been very transparent about everything that's underlying the base of a report. People should go read it for themselves.
So speaking of looking for answers, and Doss Helms, CMS and the buses, the second time in a month this week, a Charlotte school bus caught fire. It was CMS bus 188 on the way to pick up students when the driver smelled smoke. Driver evacuated as the engine burst into flames, was not injured. That followed a similar incident in October when an engine fire forced 16 South Mecklenburg High students and the driver to evacuate. What's going on here?
Well, that's a very important question. Not only in Charlotte Mecklenburg schools, but around the state, there are about 3,000 of these Freightliner Thomas Belt buses, the same make and model. About 260 of them are in CMS. And, of course, they had this first fire. There were students on the bus. Everybody got off. Nobody was badly injured. I think it was a little bit of smoke inhalation. And CMS said, well, we're going to inspect all of these 260 buses, and we're going to do a real post-mortem on the bus that caught fire, and we're going to figure out what went on. And after about 2 or 3 weeks, they said, we don't know. But we've checked all the other buses, and we're seeing no signs of trouble, so we think everything's okay. And, of course, one of those that they had inspected was the one that caught fire this week. So now they're doing it again, and they said as of yesterday they had rechecked those buses and still not finding any signs of trouble. So the longer term, you know, they've got people from Charlotte Mecklenburg schools, they've got people from the state transportation folks, and then they've got people from Thomas Belt all pouring over this bus to say what went wrong here. They're basically looking at three broad categories. There could be a flaw with the actual mechanics of this bus, in which case, you know, and these are both about 15 years old, high mileage, so maybe there's something that you need to know, that this is going to go wrong after a certain number of miles. The other thing could be, it could be the CMS staff, the mechanics, basically, and we know we do more busing here in Charlotte Mecklenburg than any place else in North Carolina. The demand has been growing. They have 42 of these crucial mechanic positions, and 8 of them are vacant. They're saying no shortcuts. It's all overtime, but that's a lot of work to spread around. So it could be a staff servicing, maintenance, inspection kind of thing. And they're also checking, I think, the fairly remote possibility that somebody is actually intentionally doing something to these buses. They're looking at footage of the bus lot to see if anybody was at this bus shortly before this happened. And I would note with the potential that it's a maintenance problem, you kind of have that bolstered by the fact that on the second day of school you had a bus where literally the back wheels fell off and went rolling into traffic. And that they do know what happened, although they say it's really weird. They say the person who was supposed to do the final torque wrench tightening on the lug nuts didn't do it, and somehow all of those lug nuts popped off and the the wheels detached. So they have, in response to that, they have bought these devices that basically have a visual signal of where those lug nuts are when they're tightened. So if they're all in the right pattern, you have every reason to believe they're still tight. And if one of them's pointing off in the wrong direction, you can visually look at that and say, ooh, we need to check that one.
Probably not the things you want to pop up on the new CMS app, school bus app. So,
yeah, we have wondered if there is an actual signal for, sorry, your bus caught fire.
What's been the response from students and parents so far?
Well, I think there's concern. I don't know, you know, there was the question was raised of should you just pull all of these 260, and that's out of a fleet of about 1,400. It includes activity buses and spares, but that's a large enough number that if you said, as a precaution, we're taking them all out, you would have to redo some routes. So you wonder if families would be okay if you said, as a precaution, we've taken them all out. By the way, your bus is coming an hour earlier in the morning because, you know, we're doubling up on runs. So there does not seem to be a great answer, but CMS's response has been, until we have identified a problem, if and when we believe that these buses are actually unsafe, we're not going to pull them off the road.
All right. We have a new Elon poll this week that looks at North Carolina voters' views on Russian interference in the 2016 election, President Trump, and other issues. Trump's approval, by the way, improved to 37% in North Carolina from 34% in October. But I wanted to talk a little bit about the North Carolina politicians a little closer to home. Tom, what do you make of the numbers? Governor Cooper, 49% approval rating, and Senators Burr and Tillis come in at 31 and 28% respectively.
I think the Cooper number, Governor Cooper number, is interesting because as the poll notes in its crosstabs, this includes a cross-section of some Republicans. So Governor Cooper's approval rating is not just a factor of Democratic support. 49%, you know, you're still underwater. It means, you know, either 51% either disapprove or aren't sure of how you're performing. But that's actually these days with the political tribes that you see busting out all over the place. It's a very good number.
It's a strong number.
Yeah, and especially when you look at the crosstabs of the Elon poll, what's interesting to me is it looks like they may have oversampled Republicans and unaffiliateds in this poll. When you look at the percentage of, you know, registered Democrats, registered unaffiliateds, and registered Republicans in the state. But when it comes to the senators, it all goes back to a key question, which the poll also looked at, which is, do you think that the federal investigation of Russian interference in the 2016 election is a serious matter or just politics? And, you know, that question also breaks down on how you think about President Trump's approval rating. It breaks down on political, you know, biases.
Yeah, didn't the political director say that voters are living in separate universes or something to that effect?
And I, you know, he will refer to separate universes, and I won't get into string theory here, but I, instead I will just refer to it as the political tribes. But I think that's where you start to see Senator Tillis and Senator Burr's approval ratings get affected. It's really common for us overall to have polls that say, we really don't like Congress, we really don't like our senators. You know, I think Burr's approval rating was probably dragged down by those people who don't think the Russia investigation is anything but politics. And Tillis has not been as visible as other senators lately. So that's what my take on the poll.
We're going to take a break. When the news roundup returns, we're going to dig into the latest at Cardinal Health. We're going to talk about Silent Sam making some noise and magnet schools. Stay with us.
The Friday News Roundup continues on Charlotte Talks in just a moment here on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE. Our support comes from WFAE members and Blumenthal Performing Arts, presenting The Sound of Music with a new production of the Rodgers and Hammerstein musical, November 24th to 26th at Belk Theater. Tickets at BlumenthalArts.org and Blue Cross and Blue Shield of North Carolina, providing members with Blue Connect, a suite of online tools that help individuals compare doctors and hospitals on the quality and cost of care. Coming up in 20 minutes at 10 o'clock on Point, Tom Ashbrook continues the look at the week's news with a roundtable looking at national news. More women accuse Roy Moore and now Senator Al Franken. The status of the tax bill, Jeff Sessions talks Russia, and more. That's in 20 minutes at 10 o'clock on Point, here on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE.
All Things Considered on WFAE helps you go beneath the surface of the day's news.
Houses of worship have long been targets for violence, for reasons ranging from the ideological to the personal. The challenge is how to create spaces that are harder to attack without turning them into fortresses. In Nashville, many...
There's more to every story. Listen weekday afternoons from 4 to 6:30 for All Things Considered from NPR News and 90.7 WFAE.
All right, back on Charlotte Talks. I'm Eric Spanberg in for Mike Collins, and this is the Weekly News Roundup. Our panel today includes Tom Bullock from WFAE, Kirsten Garris from Spectrum News, Ann Doss Helms from the Charlotte Observer, and Nick Oxner from WBTV. I have to keep Tom and Nick separate at all times. They don't play well together always. So
that's actually true.
They're sitting next to each other, though.
See, ladies, no problem. And you reported this week on earlier deadlines for magnet school applications. Tell us a little bit about what is driving that change.
Well, I think the big message is don't be in cruise control. If you think you know how everything works in Charlotte-Mecklenburg schools, it's changing. And as you may recall, we had lots and lots of discussion about all these student assignment changes, some magnet program changes that were approved in last November, and then some boundary changes and other issues that were approved in May. And then we've kind of had this hiatus year where it didn't take effect, but they're gearing up for it. So, A, if you think you know my neighborhood is assigned to this school and I like it or I don't like it, you need to check because that might be changing. And even if you're still at the same school, the makeup of that school might be changing. Some schools that were full magnet schools got neighborhood zones. Some neighborhood zones are getting new magnet programs. So you need to be getting up to speed, and you need to be doing this earlier. If you're used to the way things are done, you kind of got through the holidays, and then you realized, okay, it's time to decide whether I need to file a magnet application. Well, if you wait till January, you've missed your chance at the most popular magnets because it started this week, and it will be open through December 18th. And a key there is it doesn't matter if you file it today or, you know, December 17th. As long as you hit that deadline, you will be in that first drawing. With one exception, if you are not in CMS now, if your children are not in CMS, like, for instance, they're going to be in kindergarten or they're really young but you want them to get a pre-K seat in a Montessori magnet, you need to get them enrolled. All you do is enroll for CMS. You don't pick a school, but you have to do that by December 1st, which is really creeping up on us. So for a lot of families, this is, if you haven't already, this is really the time to get serious about understanding what your options are. And, of course, there are also public charter schools, which are not a part of CMS but are really where a lot of families are going. They are all done individually, so you need to figure out what those are and go to their websites because a lot of them are also taking applications.
So your story ran, was it Monday, Tuesday?
I think so, Tuesday, Wednesday.
Okay, so did people immediately begin mashing the panic button? What's been the response from parents so far? Or do they know what's coming?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I didn't get, you know, hordes of calls of panicked people. I think CMS probably has been. In fact, one of the other changes that's out there is, and this actually started this current year, but the low-performing schools, if they're labeled low-performing 3 years in a row, there's a special priority for the students who are assigned there to get out. They expanded it by adding students, for instance, who would be in kindergarten who have not actually attended but now can choose not to attend that school. And B, the thing they really did not want, which was the performance was not so great this past year. So there are now 16 schools on that list as opposed to, I think, six. So I did hear from one parent who said, you know, I realized that I have this option as my child goes into middle school. I want to exercise it. I want to understand it. Had a very hard time figuring out how the system works and then started calling the numbers that were out there and getting repeated tapes that say the volume is high, we value your call, click, you're disconnected. So I don't know if that was one extremely bad experience or if this is widespread, but certainly that whole customer service angle of it, as people go, oh, wow, I need to make a decision quick and this is complicated, you need to have people who can answer those questions.
So that means plenty of follow-up stories for you.
Yes, sort of like that.
Keeping the cup half full. Kirsten, you never like to mention that you attended UNC Chapel Hill, but I'm going to state that publicly. It's okay. They didn't. The national championship is still intact. It's okay.
We are still national champions until next April.
The Silent Sam Confederate Memorial has been a topic on campus, particularly in the last few months. after the Charlottesville violence over removing the Robert E. Lee statue in Virginia. What's the latest in terms of UNC Chapel Hill and Silent Sam? I believe initially Governor Cooper had said it could be moved according to a kind of unwieldy state statute. So where are they now?
Yes, yeah. It's one of those yes and no. If it were called cause physical harm, they could remove the statue, but that's not the Board of Trustees says that it doesn't fit that description for in this case. But most recently, this past week, there was another rally at Silent Sam, students and activists calling for its removal. And then also on Wednesday, several people, almost 30, showed up at a Board of Trustees meeting, talked during their public comment section, asking and advocating for against Silent Sam's removal. It's a Confederate statue, literally kind of at the university's front door.
I was going to say, I mean, you can't miss it. When you walk on campus, it's right there.
Exactly. And it's one thing that as a student, you walk past it all the time. So that's what people were saying. Some students were saying, you know, this is something that you passed every day. And if you're a student of color, it was hard to see this image of Confederacy right there on your doorstep. But those on the other end of the spectrum were saying, you know, well, this is a piece of history. This is preserving history. So it's the same arguments we've kind of heard nationally, which is preserving history versus, you know, remembering that, yes, this is history, but it's a very discriminatory portion of history. But right now, the Silent Sam is still kind of in limbo. Chancellor Carol Folt hasn't said whether the statue, she hasn't made any promises that Silent Sam will be moving anytime soon, but she does appreciate that at least the Board of Trustees could hear both sides. So it's safe to say Silent Sam hasn't been too silent, but this is something that, I mean, students have been talking about since I was there.
I was going to ask you, what was your experience when you were there in terms of people talking about it?
We weren't protesting in the same degree. We didn't have a Charlottesville incident that really, I think, catapulted what Confederate statues mean to people across the country, but it was still a topic of discussion. And even at UNC, people have been talking about different buildings that were named after folks who should be changed. I mean, shortly after I left, students made a big pitch to change a building that was named after a former KKK member, and that got changed. So, I mean, UNC does have a history of not some of the best things of our Southern history, but students have been talking about this for years. So at UNC, at least, this is not a new issue. It's just gotten new light because of the national spotlight of Charlottesville. But for now, it'll be interesting to see what happens. The problem is Carol Folt has said she wouldn't mind removing the statue or relocating the statue, somewhere else, but she can't because of a 2015 state law that prohibits the removal of monuments from state public property, which is UNC Chapel Hill.
And the governor, I think his basic argument was he was trying to take that physical hazard and argue that protests and things like that could cause people physical harm, and that's kind of where opinions start to differ.
But it doesn't really get you around that law. I mean,
law is still. And in August, there was shortly after the Charlottesville incident, there was a big rally where that's when the governor made that pitch saying, hey, you know, I know people are upset. They put guardrails around Silent Sam. There were police officers there, so the image wasn't the best. So I think that's why Rick Cooper was like, hey, if you need to remove this before this rally, that was, I think, the physical harm he was alluding to. Now, that physical harm argument doesn't quite hold up.
Although he did say this week to a report at the News and Observer that he stood by his remarks from earlier this year. So the governor still stands by that, even though it remains to be seen of whether or not what he said earlier this year comports with the law that says you can't move the statue.
And he wants to move it to a state park, is that right?
To the Bentonville Battlefield,
right.
I think,
okay.
Which is a Civil War battlefield.
Yep. Right, okay. I'm sure we will hear more about that. And by the way, for people who want to dig into that a little more, Mike Collins was with UNC-TV this week as part of a show about Confederate monuments. You can go to wfae.org/Charlotte Talks if you want to hear that. And moving away from Confederate monuments, let's talk about Cardinal Health. Tom, you had a report this morning that aired on WFAE. For those that may not be familiar with Cardinal, they're a company that handles nearly $700 million worth of state work, providing mental health, substance abuse treatment, and developmental disability services to Medicaid patients in 20 counties across the state. So they've had trouble already through some state audits. What's happening to them now?
Exactly. And I want to give credit to both. I have a report out this morning, as does my reporting partner on this project, Alex Olgan. So Cardinal, just to be clear, Cardinal is like the biggest pseudo insurance company most people probably haven't heard of in the state. They don't actually provide care. They basically handle out – they basically are the payment wing for Medicaid.
They administer.
Exactly. So these two audits that came out, one in May, the other in October, were both, I mean, scathing. And it first and foremost has to do with some pretty significant pay for Cardinals CEO Richard Topping, including his bonus, which was $100,000. He made $617,000 last year. And there's some difference of opinion here, but under statute now that has been codified and clarified, people who run organizations like Cardinal, they're called LME MCOs, are only supposed to make, by state rule, $204,000 and change. So in October, to comport with state law and clarification on this issue from the Office of State Human Resources, Cardinal slashed Richard Topping's salary by $400,000 plus or minus some. And it didn't go over well. Richard Topping said, not going to do that. I can't accept that. But he is still the CEO at Cardinal. So what may happen tonight, this is the first board meeting since they slashed his salary, and we don't yet know exactly what's going to happen. But this is one of those issues that you can't see a board just sitting on. Richard Topping officially has 90 days to decide whether he accepts the salary pay cut and stays on or leaves. He is now, we are told, being paid the $204,000. So, you know, he's got a choice to make. And it may come down, we may find out as early as tonight whether or not he's going to leave. But that brings us to the second audit and what is potentially even more intriguing.
Severance packages, right?
Exactly. You often hear about private companies getting, you know, their executives having golden parachutes. Number one, Cardinal is not a private company. It's not exactly a nonprofit. It's this kind of pseudo branch, though it is not an agency. It is a nonprofit contractor is probably the easiest way to say it, to administer taxpayer money through Medicaid. So I would actually call, given that strange categorization, I would call these more like platinum parachutes. So Richard Topping could be eligible for up to 3 years at full salary, and that full salary we don't know yet, but may be the $617,000 or minus his $100,000 bonus, the $500,000 salary.
Still doing pretty well either way.
For up to 3 years after he leaves, and he can leave for a whole bunch of interesting reasons according to these contracts.
And this is public money, right?
And this is public money, exactly right. Imagine if this was happening at, say, a well-recognized branch of state or local government, the outrage would be enormous.
If we're going on at CMS, people would have a lot of problems.
Absolutely. That's exactly fair.
And in the brief time that I was covering them, what they always said was, well, this is not coming out of patient services. We have a separate pool for staffing and administration, so we're not taking money away from Medicaid patients, but it's still public money.
Yeah.
And if he goes away and keeps getting paid, you know, somebody else is going to come in and presumably get another nice salary.
Well, and here's the thing. It's not just Richard Topping that has the platinum parachute,
right,
as I'll call
this
it.
This is the key point.
This is absolutely key, Eric. You're right. It's Topping and 10 top executives, which include the entire C-suite. And in those severance contracts, auditors found that they can claim that severance and leave if there's a change in the CEO. And, you know, I asked a member of DHHS, the North Carolina Department of Health and Human Services, who runs the Medicaid portion of things, watches over all this, because when I read that in the audit, the first thing that hit me is this seems to incentivize loyalty to the CEO over responsibility of the organization that they're trying to lead, that they're there to lead. And the response I got back was, yes, that's right. So tonight could be a very interesting night for Cardinal, because we could find out, and we don't know yet if we will or not, we could find out whether the CEO sticks around and if there are any knock-on effects of these other 10 employees exercise that unusual clause and they bolt, and they would get up to 2 years severance at full salary. So
now, at the opposite end of the spectrum, Ann, I want to ask you a little bit about a state concern and a pay concern, which involves these prison workers. Last month, there were four prison workers who were fatally injured in a failed escape attempt. And since then, the Observer has done a lot of reporting about the low pay, long hours, frankly, bad conditions that are faced by prison workers across the state. What are you finding?
Well, I think what they found this latest round of information was about the vacancy rates, which are up to 16% statewide compared with 9% a year ago. That's obviously, you know, we talked about spreading the labor around among bus mechanics, which is important. But when you talk prison guards and prison staffing, those vacancies mean each person who's still there is supervising an even larger number of inmates. And I believe Gavin and Ames found that they were averaging, I think, something like 30 or 40, but there were, in some cases, you might be keeping your eye on 100 people. And it does not take any imagination at all, because we have some videos that are out there of what happens when one or more of these people decides to attack a staffer. Do you have the people who can immediately respond and immediately come to this person's aid or not?
Well, and so, we know the answer is or not, right?
Right, we know it's not.
We know the report of Pasquotank from the attempted prison escape last month. It took 20 minutes for them to respond to that attack from the time it started.
Yeah.
And I spoke last night with the aunt of the fourth person who died in that attack, Jeffrey Howe, in a story, and she questioned why state leaders hadn't done anything to start addressing some of these systemic problems after Megan Callahan died at the Bertie Correctional Facility, a sergeant at that prison, in April. And it's a question that the Secretary of Public Safety said he was too busy to do an interview about, and the governor refused to answer when I questioned him about it.
But why do you think – I mean, this one seems like such a clear-cut issue. Why do you think – whether it's the governor or whether it's leaders in the General Assembly, why isn't more being done on that?
I think we are going to see more being done from the General
Assembly. Although I don't think there is a simple fix. I mean, certainly raising salaries and doing more recruitment and retention would be key, but there's a saying that gets chanted a lot at these protests, and I can't give it in its entirety on the air, but it's basically the whole system is guilty. And we do have a system where we in the United States are incarcerating huge numbers of people and putting them into a system that doesn't do a lot to treat mental health or to rehabilitate them. So there is a broad systemic issue, but there's also this immediate $38,000 to put your life at risk is not a lot of money.
Those are the words of Andos Helms. She gets the last word. She's from the Charlotte Observer. I also want to thank Kirsten Garris from Spectrum News, Nick Oxner from WBTV, Tom Bullock from WFAE, and I'm Eric Spanberg. And for Mike Collins, thanks for listening to the Friday News Roundup.